Ellie was immediately sorry that such a thought had occurred to her, for it encouraged her to wonder if the kind, good man she saw in Spencer was an illusion, or at best only part of the truth. She realized, somewhat to her surprise, that she did not want to doubt Spencer Grant. Instead, she was eager to believe in him, as she had not believed in anything or anyone for a long time. "If I was blind, if I'd never seen your face, I already know you well enough that you could still break my heart." Those words had been so sincere, such an uncalculated revelation of his feelings and his vulnerability, that she had been left briefly speechless. Yet she hadn't possessed the courage to give him any reason to believe that she might be capable of reciprocating his feelings for her. Danny had been dead only 14 months, and that was, by her standards, far too short a time to grieve. To touch another man this soon, to care, to love, that seemed to be a betrayal of the man whom she had first loved, and whom she would still love to the exclusion of all others were he alive. On the other hand, 14 months of loneliness was, by any measure, an eternity. To be honest with herself, she had to admit that her reticence sprang from more than a concern about the propriety or impropriety of a 14-month period of mourning. As fine and loving as Danny had been, he never would have found it possible to bear his heart as directly or as completely as Spencer had done, repeatedly, since she'd driven him out of that dry wash in the desert. Danny had not been unromantic, but he had expressed his feelings less directly, with thoughtful gifts and kindnesses, rather than with words. As if to say, "I love you," would have been to cast a curse upon their relationship. She was unaccustomed to the rough poetry of a man like Spencer, when he spoke from his heart, and she was not sure what she thought of it. That was a lie. She liked it. More than liked it. In her hardened heart, she was surprised to find a tender place that wasn't merely responsive to Spencer's forthright expressions of love, but that longed for more. That longing was like the profound thirst of a desert traveler, and she now realized it was a thirst that had been in need of slaking all her life. She was reluctant to respond to Spencer, not primarily because she might have grieved too short a time for Danny, but because she sensed that the first love of her life might eventually prove not to be the greatest. Finding the capacity to love again seemed like a betrayal of Danny, but it was far worse, cruel rejection, to love another more than she had loved her murdered husband. Perhaps that would never happen. If she opened herself to this still mysterious man, perhaps she would ultimately discover that the room he occupied in her heart would never be as large or warm as the one in which Danny had lived and would always live. In carrying her loyalty to Danny's memory so far, she supposed that she was allowing honest sentiment to degenerate into a sugary pudding of sentimentality. Surely no one was born to love but once and never again, even if fate carried that first love to an early grave. If creation operated on rules that stern, God had built a cold, bleak universe. Surely love, and all emotions, were in one regard like muscles, growing stronger with exercise, withering when not used. Loving Danny might have given her the emotional strength in the wake of his passing to love Spencer more. And to be fair to Danny, he had been raised by a soulless father and a brittle socialite mother, in whose icy embrace he'd learned to be self-contained and guarded. He had given her all that he could give, and she had been fortunate and happy in his arms. So happy, in fact, that suddenly she could no longer imagine going through the rest of her life without seeking from someone else the gift that Danny had been the first to give her. How many women have ever affected a man so strongly that he had, after one evening of conversation, given up a comfortable existence and put his life in extreme jeopardy to be with her? She was more than merely mystified and flattered by Spencer's commitment. She felt special, foolish, girlish, reckless. She was reluctantly enchanted. Frowning, she studied Stephen Ackblom's photograph again. She knew that Spencer's commitment to her, and all that he had done to find her, might be seen as less the result of love than of obsession. In the son of a savage serial killer, any sign of obsession might reasonably be viewed as a cause for alarm, as a reflection of the father's madness. Ellie returned all four photographs to the envelope. She closed it with its small metal clasp. She believed Spencer was, in all ways that mattered, not his father's son. He was no more dangerous to her than was Mr. Rocky Dog. For 3 nights in the desert, as she had listened to him murmuring in delirium between his periodic ascensions to the shaky state of consciousness, she had heard nothing to make her suspect that he was the bad seed of a bad seed. In reality, even if Spencer was a danger to her, he was no match for the agency when it came to being a threat. The agency was still out there, hunting for them. What Ellie really needed to worry about was whether she could avoid the agency's goons long enough to discover and enjoy whatever emotional connections might evolve between her and this complex and enigmatic man. By Spencer's own admission, he had secrets that were still unrevealed. More for his sake than hers, those secrets would have to be aired before any future they might have together could be discussed or even discerned. Because until he settled his debts with the past, he would never know the peace of mind or the self-respect needed for love to flourish. She looked out at the sky again. They flew across Utah in their sleek black machine, strangers in their own land, putting the sun behind them, heading eastward toward the horizon from which, several hours hence, the night would come. Harris Decoteau showered in the gray and maroon guest bathroom of his brother's Westwood home, but the scent of the jailhouse, which he believed he could detect on himself, was ineradicable. Jessica had packed 3 changes of clothes for him on Saturday, prior to being evicted from their house in Burbank. From that meager wardrobe, he selected Nikes, gray cords, and a long-sleeved dark green knit shirt. When he told his wife that he was going for a walk, she wanted him to wait until the pies could be taken from the oven so she could go with him. Darius, busy on the telephone in his study, suggested that he delay leaving for 30 minutes so they could walk together. Harris sensed that they were concerned about his despondency. They felt he should not be alone. He reassured them that he had no intention of throwing himself in front of a truck, that he needed to exercise after a weekend in a cell, and that he wanted to be alone to think. He borrowed one of Darius's leather jackets from the foyer closet and went into the cool February morning. The residential streets of Westwood were hilly. Within a few blocks, he realized that a weekend spent sitting in a cell actually had left his muscles cramped and in need of stretching. He hadn't been telling the truth when he had said that he wanted to be alone to think. Actually, he wanted to stop thinking. Ever since the assault on his house on Friday night, his mind had been spinning ceaselessly, and thinking had gotten him nowhere but into bleaker places within himself. Even what little sleep he had gotten had been no surcease from worry, for he had dreamed about faceless men in black uniforms and shiny black jackboots. In the nightmares, they buckled Undine, Willa, and Jessica into collars and leashes, as if dealing with dogs instead of with people, and led them away, leaving Harris alone. As there was no escape from worry in his sleep, there was none in the company of Jessica or Darius. His brother was ceaselessly working on the case or brooding aloud about offensive and defensive legal strategies, and Jessica was, as Undine and Willa would be when they returned from the mall, a constant reminder that he had failed his family. None of them would say anything of that kind, of course, and he knew that the thought would never actually cross their minds. He had done nothing to earn the catastrophe that had befallen them. Yet though he was blameless, he blamed himself. Somewhere, sometime, someplace, he'd made an enemy whose retribution was psychotically in excess of whatever offense Harris unwittingly had committed. If only he had done one thing differently, avoided one offending statement or act, perhaps none of this would have happened. Every time he thought of Jessica or his daughters, his inadvertent and unavoidable culpability seemed to be a greater sin. The men in jackboots, though only creatures from his dream, had, in a very real sense, begun to deny him the comfort of his family, without the need to buckle them in leashes and lead them away. His anger and frustration at his powerlessness and his self-inflicted guilt, as surely as bricks and mortar, had become the components of a wall between him and those he loved, and this barrier was likely to become wider and higher with time. Alone, therefore, he walked the winding streets and the hills of Westwood. Many palms, ficuses, and pines kept the neighborhood California green in February, but there were also numerous sycamores and maples and birches that were bare-limbed in winter. Harris focused largely on the interesting patterns of sunlight and tree shadows that alternately swagged and filigreed the sidewalk ahead. He tried to use them to induce a state of self-imposed hypnosis in which all thought was banished except for an awareness of the need to keep putting one foot in front of the other. He had some success at that game. In a half-trance, he was only peripherally aware of the sapphire-blue Toyota that passed him, and abruptly chugging and stalling out, pulled to the curb and stopped nearly a block ahead. A man got out of the car and opened the hood, but Harris remained focused on the tapestry of sun and shade on which he trod. As Harris passed the front of the Toyota, the stranger turned from his examination of the engine and said, "Sir, may I give you something to think about?" Harris continued a couple of steps before he realized that the man was speaking to him. Halting, turning, rising from his self-induced hypnosis, he said, "Excuse me?" The stranger was a tall black man in his late 20s. He was as skinny as a 14-year-old, with the somber and intense manner of an elderly man who has seen too much and carried too great a grief all his life. Dressed in black slacks, a black turtleneck sweater, and a black jacket, he seemed to want to project an ominous image, but if that was his intention, it was defeated by his large bottle-thick glasses, his thinness, and a voice which, while deep, was as velvety and appealing as that of Mel Torme. "May I give you something to think about?" he asked again. And then he continued without waiting for a response. "What's happened to you couldn't happen to a United States representative or senator." The street was uncannily quiet for being in such a metropolitan area. The sunlight seemed different from what it had been a moment ago. The glimmer that it laid along the curved surfaces of the blue Toyota struck Harris as unnatural. "Most people are unaware of it," said the stranger, "but for decades politicians have exempted current and future members of the U.S. Congress from most of the laws they pass. Asset forfeiture, for one. If cops nail a senator peddling cocaine out of his Cadillac by a schoolyard, his car can't be seized the way your house was." Harris had the peculiar feeling that he had hypnotized himself so well that this tall man in black was an apparition in a trance-state dream. "You might be able to prosecute him for drug dealing and get a conviction, unless his fellow politicians just censure him or expel him from Congress, and at the same time arrange his immunity from prosecution. But you couldn't seize his assets for drug dealing or any of the other 200 offenses for which they seize yours." Harris said, "Who are you?" Ignoring the question, the stranger went on in that soft voice. "Politicians pay no Social Security taxes. They have their own retirement fund, and they don't rob it to finance other programs the way they drain Social Security. Their pensions are safe." Harris looked anxiously around the street to see who might be watching, what other vehicles and men might have accompanied this man. Although the stranger wasn't threatening, the situation itself suddenly seemed ominous. He felt that he was being set up, as if the point of the encounter was to tease from him some seditious statement for which he could be arrested, prosecuted, and imprisoned. That was an absurd fear. Free speech was still well guaranteed. No citizens of the world were as openly and heatedly opinionated as his countrymen. Recent events obviously had inspired a paranoia over which he needed to gain control. Yet he remained afraid to speak. The stranger said, "They exempt themselves from health care plans they intend to force on you, so someday you'll have to wait months for things like gallbladder surgery, but they'll get the care they need on demand. Somehow we've allowed ourselves to be ruled by the greediest and most envious among us." Harris found the nerve to speak again, but only to repeat the question he had already asked and to add another. "Who are you? What do you want?" "I only want to give you something to think about until the next time," said the stranger. Then he turned and slammed shut the hood of the blue Toyota. Emboldened when the other's back was to him, Harris stepped off the curb and grabbed the man by the arm. "Look here, I have to go," the stranger said. "As far as I know, we're not being watched. The chances are 1,000 to 1. But with today's technology, you can't be 100% sure anymore. Until now, to anyone observing us, you just seem to have struck up a conversation with a guy who has car trouble, offered some assistance. But if we stand here talking any longer, and if someone is watching, they'll come in for a closer look and turn on their directional microphones." He went to the driver's door of his Toyota. Bewildered, Harris said, "But what is this all about?" "Be patient, Mr. Decoteau. Just go with the flow. Just ride the wave and you'll find out."
"What wave?"
Opening the driver's door, the stranger cracked his first smile since he had spoken.
"Well, I guess the microwave. The light wave, the waves of the future."
He got in the car, started the engine, and drove away, leaving Harris more bewildered than ever. The microwave, the light wave, the waves of the future. What the hell had just happened? Harris Decoteau turned in a circle, studying the neighborhood, and for the most part it seemed unremarkable. Sky and earth, houses and trees, lawns and sidewalks, sunlight and shadows. But in the fabric of the day, glimmering darkly in the deep warp and woof, were threads of mystery that had not been there earlier. He walked on. Periodically, however, as he had not done before, he glanced over his shoulder. Roy Miro in the Empire of the Mormons. After dealing with the Cedar City police and the county sheriff's deputies for nearly 2 hours, Roy had experienced enough niceness to last him until at least the 1st of July. He understood the value of a smile, courtesy, and unfailing friendliness because he'd used a disarming approach in his own work. But these Mormon cops carried it to extremes. He began to long for the cool indifference of Los Angeles, the hard selfishness of Las Vegas, even the surliness and insanity of New York. His mood was not enhanced by the news of Earthguard's shutdown. He had been further rattled by subsequently learning that the stolen helicopter had descended to such a low altitude that 2 military facilities tracking it, in response to urgent agency requests that they believed had come from the Drug Enforcement Administration, had lost the craft. They hadn't been able to reacquire it. The fugitives were gone, and only God and a couple of kidnapped pilots knew where. Roy dreaded having to make his report to Tom Summerton. The replacement Jet Ranger was due from Las Vegas in less than 20 minutes, but he didn't know what he was going to do with it. Park it in the shopping center lot and sit in it, waiting for someone to sight the fugitives? He might still be there when the time rolled around to do Christmas shopping again. Besides, these Mormon cops would undoubtedly keep bringing him coffee and donuts, and they would hang around to help him pass the time. He was spared all the horrors of continued niceness when Gary Duval telephoned again from Colorado and put the investigation back on track. The call came through on the scrambler-equipped security phone in the disabled chopper. Roy sat in the back of the cabin and put on the headset.
"You're not easy to track down," Duval told him.
"Complications here," Roy said succinctly. "You're still in Colorado? I thought you'd be on your way back to San Francisco by this time."
"I got interested in this Ackblom angle. Always been fascinated by these serial killers. Dahmer, Bundy, that Ed Gein fellow a lot of years ago. Weird stuff. Got me to wondering what in hell the son of a serial killer is doing mixed up with this woman."
"We're all wondering," Roy assured him.
As before, Duval was going to pay out whatever he had learned in small installments.
"While I was so close, I decided to hop over from Denver to Vail, have a look at the ranch where it happened. It's a quick flight, almost took longer to board and disembark than it took to get there."
"You're there now?"
"At the ranch? No, I just got back from there. But I'm still in Vail. And wait till you hear what I discovered."
"I guess I'll have to."
"Huh?"
"Wait," Roy said. Either missing the sarcasm or ignoring it, Duval said,
"I got 2 tasty enchiladas of information to feed you. Enchilada number 1. What do you think happened to the ranch after they took all the bodies out of there and Ackblom went to prison for life?"
"It became a retreat for Carmelite nuns," Roy said.
"Where'd you hear that?" Duval asked,
unaware that Roy's answer had been intended to be humorous.
"Aren't any nuns anywhere around the place. There's this couple lives on the ranch, Paul and Anita Dresman, been there for years, 15 years. Everyone around Vail thinks they own the place, and they don't let on any different. They're only about 55 now, but they have the look and style of people who might have been able to retire at 40, which is what they claimed. Or never worked at all, lived on inheritance. They're perfect for the job."
"What job?"
"Caretakers."
"Who does own it?"
"That's the creepy part."
"I'm sure it is."
"Part of the Dresman's job is to pretend ownership and not reveal their paid caretakers. They like to ski, live the easy life, and it doesn't bother them to be living in a place with that reputation, so keeping their mouths shut has been easy."
"But they opened up to you?"
"Well, you know, people take FBI credentials and a few threats of criminal charges a lot more seriously than they should," Duval said. "Anyway, until about 1.5 years ago, they were paid by an attorney in Denver."
"You've got his name?"
"Bentley Lingerhold, but I don't think we'll need to bother with him. Until 1.5 years ago, the Dresman's checks were issued from a trust fund, the Vail Memorial Trust, overseen by this attorney. I had my field computer with me, got online with Mama, had her track it down. It's a defunct entity, but there's still a record of it. Actually, it was managed by another trust that still exists, the Spencer Grant Living Trust."
"Good God," Roy said.
"Stunning, huh?"
"The son still owns that property?"
"Yeah, through other entities he controls. 1.5 years ago, ownership was transferred from the Vail Memorial Trust, which was essentially owned by the son, to an offshore corporation on Grand Cayman Island. That's a tax shelter haven in the Caribbean that..."
"Yes, I know. Go on."
Since then, the Dresmans have been getting their checks from something called Vanishment International. Through Mama, I got into the Grand Cayman Bank, where the account is located. I wasn't able to learn its value or call up any transaction records, but I was able to find out that Vanishment is controlled by a Swiss-based holding company, Amelia Earhart Enterprises.
Roy fidgeted in his seat, wishing that he brought a pen and notebook to keep all these details straight.
Duval said, "The grandparents, George and Ethel Porth, formed the Vale Memorial Trust well over 15 years ago, about 6 months after the Ackblom story exploded. They used it to manage the property at a one-step remove to keep their names disassociated from it."
"Why didn't they sell the place?"
"Haven't a clue. Anyway, a year later, they set up the Spencer Grant Living Trust for the boy here in Denver, through this Bentley Lingerhold, just after the kid had his name legally changed. At the same time, they put that trust in charge of the Vale Memorial Trust. But Vanishment International came into existence just a year and a half ago, long after both grandparents were dead. So you've got to figure that Grant himself set it up, and that he's moved most of his assets out of the United States."
"Starting at about the same time he began to eliminate his name from most public records," Roy mused. "Okay, tell me something. When you're talking trusts and offshore corporations, you're talking about big money, aren't you?"
"Big,"
Duval confirmed. "Where'd it come from? I mean, I know the father was famous."
"After the old man pleaded guilty to all those murders, you know what happened to him?"
"Tell me."
"He accepted a sentence of life imprisonment in an institution for the criminally insane. No possibility of parole. He made no arguments, no appeals. The guy was absolutely serene from the moment he was arrested all the way through the final proceeding. Not one outburst, no expressions of regret."
"No point. He knew he didn't have any defense. He wasn't crazy."
"He wasn't?"
Duval said, surprised.
"Well, not irrational, not babbling or raving or anything like that. He knew he couldn't get off. He was just being realistic." "I guess so. Anyway, then the grandparents moved to have the son declared the legal owner of Ackblom's assets. In fact, at the Porth's request, the court ultimately divided the liquidated assets, minus the ranch, between the boy and the immediate families of the victims, in those cases where any spouses or children survived them. Want to guess how much they split?"
"No," Roy said. He glanced out the porthole and saw a pair of local cops walking alongside the aircraft, looking it over. Duval didn't even hesitate at Roy's no, but poured out more details.
"Well, the money came from selling paintings from Ackblom's personal collection of other artists' work, but mainly from the sale of some of his own paintings that he'd never been willing to put on the market. It totaled a little more than $29 million.
After taxes?
See, the value of his paintings soared with the notoriety. Seems funny, doesn't it, that anyone would want to hang his work in their homes, knowing what the artist did? You'd think the value of his stuff would just collapse. But there was a frenzy in the art market. Values went through the roof."
Roy remembered the color plates of Ackblom's work that he had studied as a boy at the time the story broke, and he couldn't quite understand Duval's point. Ackblom's art was exquisite. If Roy could have afforded to buy them, he would have decorated his own home with dozens of the artist's canvases.
Duval said, "Prices have continued to climb all these years, though more slowly than in the first year after. The family would have been better off holding on to some of the art. Anyway, the boy ended up with $14.5 million after taxes. Unless he lives high on the hog, that ought to have grown into an even more substantial fortune over all these years."
Roy thought of the cabin in Malibu, the cheap furniture and walls without any artwork. No high living.
"Really? Well, you know, his old man didn't live nearly as high as he could have, either. He refused to have a bigger house, didn't want any live-in servants, just a day maid and a property foreman who went home at 5 o'clock. Ackblom said he needed to keep his life as simple as possible to preserve his creative energy."
Gary Duval laughed.
"Of course, he really just didn't want anyone around at night to catch him at his games under the barn."
Wandering back along the side of the chopper again, the Mormon cops looked up at Roy, where he was watching them from the porthole. He waved. They waved and smiled.
"Still," Duval said, "it's a wonder the wife didn't tumble to it sooner. He'd been experimenting with his performance art for 4 years before she got wise."
"She wasn't an artist."
"What?"
"She didn't have the vision to anticipate. Without the vision to anticipate, she wouldn't become suspicious without good reason."
Can't say I follow you. 4 years, for heaven's sake."
"Then 6 more, until the boy had found out. 10 years, 42 victims. slightly more than 4 a year. The numbers, Roy decided, weren't particularly impressive. The factors that made Stephen Ackblom one for the record books were his fame before his secret life was discovered, his position of respect in his community, his status as a family man, most classic serial killers were loners, and his desire to apply his exceptional talent to the art of torture in order to help his subjects achieve a moment of perfect beauty. But why, Roy wondered again, would the son want to hold on to that property with all its associations? He wanted to change his name. Why not rid himself of the ranch, too?
Strange, huh?
And if not the son, why not the grandparents? Why didn't they sell it off when they were his legal guardians, make that decision for him? After their daughter was killed there, why would they want to have anything to do with the place?
There's something there, Duval said.
What do you mean?
Some explanation, some reason. Whatever it is, it's weird.
The caretaker couple,
Paul and Anita Dresman,
did they say whether Grant ever comes around?
He doesn't. At least they've never seen anybody with a scar like he's got.
So who oversees them?
Until a year and a half ago, they only ever saw 2 people related to the Vale Memorial Trust. This lawyer, Lingerhold, or one of his partners, would come by 2x a year just to check that the ranch was being maintained, that the Dresmans were earning their salary and spending the upkeep fund on genuinely needed maintenance.
And for the past year and a half?
Since Vanishment International has owned the place, nobody's come around at all, Duval said. God, I'd love to find out how much he's got stashed away in Amelia Earhart Enterprises. But you know we're never going to pry that out of the Swiss.
In recent years, Switzerland had grown alarmed by the large number of cases in which U.S. authorities had sought to seize the Swiss accounts of American citizens by invoking asset forfeiture statutes without proof of criminal activity. The Swiss increasingly viewed such laws as blunt tools of political repression. Every month they retreated further from their traditional cooperation in criminal cases. "What's the other taco?" Roy asked.
"Huh?"
"The second taco. You said you had 2 tacos to feed me."
"Enchiladas," Duval said. "2 enchiladas of information."
"Well, I'm hungry," Roy said pleasantly. He was proud of his patience after all the tests to which the Mormon cops had put it. "So why don't you heat up that second enchilada?" Gary Duval served it to him, and it was as tasty as promised. The moment he hung up on Duval, Roy called the Vegas office and spoke to Ken Hickman, who would soon conclude his shift as the morning duty officer. "Ken, where's that jet ranger?"
10 minutes from you."
"I'm going to send it back with most of the men here."
"You're giving up?"
"You know we've lost radar contact on them."
"Right."
"They're gone, and we're not going to reconnect with them that way. But I have another lead, a good one, and I'm jumping on it. I need a jet."
"Jesus."
"I didn't say I needed to hear a little profanity."
"Sorry."
"What about the Lear I came in on Friday night?"
"It's still here, serviced and ready."
"Is there anywhere in my vicinity it can land, any military base where I could meet it?"
"Let me check,"
Hickman said, and he put Roy on hold. While he waited, Roy thought about Eve Jammer. He would not be able to return to Las Vegas that evening. He wondered what his blonde sweetness would do to remember him and to keep him in her heart. She had said that it would be something special. He assumed she would practice new positions, if there were any, and try out erotic aids that she had never used before, in order to prepare an experience for him that a night or two hence would leave him shuddering and breathless as never before. When he attempted to imagine what those erotic aids might be, his mind spun and his mouth went as dry as sand, which was perfect. Ken Hickman came back on the line.
"We can put the Lear down right there in Cedar City."
"This burg can take a Lear?"
"Brianhead is just 29 miles east of there."
"Who?"
"Not who, what. A first-rate ski resort, lots of pricey homes up on the mountain. Lots of rich people and corporations own condos in Brianhead, bring their jets into Cedar City and drive up from there. It doesn't have anything like O'Hare or LAX, no bars and newsstands and baggage carousels, but the airfield can handle long landing requirements."
"Is a crew standing by with the Lear?"
"Absolutely. We can get them out of McCarran and to you by 1 o'clock.
"Terrific. I'll ask one of the grinning gendarmes to drive me to the airfield."
"Who?"
"One of the courteous constables," Roy said. He was in a fine mood again.
"I'm not sure this scrambler is giving me what you're saying."
"One of the Mormon marshals." Either getting the point or deciding that he didn't need to understand, Hickman said, They'll have to file a flight plan here. Where are you going from Cedar City?
Denver, Roy said.
Slumped in the last seat in the starboard aisle, Ellie dozed on and off for a couple of hours. In 14 months as a fugitive, she had learned to put aside her fears and worries, sleeping whenever she had a chance. Shortly after she woke, while she was stretching and yawning, Spencer returned from an extended visit with the two-man crew. He sat across from her. As Rocky curled up in the aisle at his feet, Spencer said, "More good news. According to the boys, this is an extensively customized egg beater. For one thing, they have jumped-up engines on this baby, so we can carry an extra heavy load, which allows them to saddle her with big auxiliary fuel tanks. She's got a lot more range than the standard model. They're sure they can get us all the way across the border and past Grand Junction before there's any danger of the tanks running dry, if we want to go that far."
"The farther the better," she said. "But not right in or around Grand Junction. We don't want to be seen by a lot of curious people. Better out somewhere, but not so far out that we can't find wheels nearby."
"We won't make it to the Grand Junction area until half an hour or so before twilight. Right now it's only 2:10. Well, 3:00 in the mountain time zone. Still plenty of time to look at a map and pick a general area to put down."
She pointed to the canvas duffel bag on the seat in front of hers. "Listen, about your $50,000.
He held up one hand to silence her. "I was just startled that you found it, that's all. You had every right and reason to search my luggage after you located me in the desert. You didn't know why the hell I was trying to track you down. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if you still weren't entirely clear on that."
"You always carry that kind of pocket change?"
"About 1.5 years ago, he said, "I started salting cash and gold coins in safe deposit boxes in California, Nevada, Arizona. Also opened savings accounts in various cities under false names and social security numbers. Shifted everything else out of the country."
"Why?"
"So I could move fast."
"You expected to be on the run like this?"
"No, I just didn't like what I saw happening on that computer crime task force. They taught me all about computers, including that access to information is the essence of freedom. And yet what they ultimately wanted to do was restrict that access in as many instances as possible and to the greatest extent possible."
Playing devil's advocate, Ellie said, "I thought the idea was just to prevent criminal hackers from using computers to steal and maybe stop them from vandalizing databanks."
"And I'm all for that kind of crime control, but they want to keep a thumb on everybody. Most authorities these days, they violate privacy all the time, phishing both openly and secretly in databanks. Everyone from the IRS to the Immigration and Naturalization Service, even the Bureau of Land Management, for God's sake. They were all helping to fund this regional task force with grants, and they all gave me the creeps."
"You see a new world coming."
"Like a runaway freight train."
"And you don't like the shape of it."
"Don't think I want to be part of it."
"Do you see yourself as a cyberpunk, an online outlaw?"
"No, just a survivor."
"Is that why you've been erasing yourself from public record, a little survival insurance?"
No shadow fell across him, but his features seemed to darken. He had looked haggard to begin with, which was understandable after the ordeal of the past few days, but now he was sunken-eyed, gaunt, and older than his years. He said, "At first I was just getting ready to go away." He sighed and wiped a hand across his face. "It sounds strange, maybe, but changing my name from Michael Ackblom to Spencer Grant wasn't enough. Moving from Colorado, starting a new life, none of it was ever enough. I couldn't forget who I was. Whose son I was. So I decided to wipe myself out of existence, painstakingly, methodically, until there was no record in the world that I existed under any name. What I'd been learning about computers gave me that power."
"And then, when you were erased?"
"That's what I could never figure out. And then, what next? Wipe myself out for real? Suicide?"
"That's not you." She found her heart sinking at the thought.
"No, not me," he agreed. "I never brooded about eating a shotgun barrel or anything like that, and I had an obligation to Rocky to be here for him."
Sprawled on the deck, the dog raised his head at the sound of his name. He swished his tail.
"Then after a while," he continued, "even though I didn't know what I was going to do, I decided that there was still virtue in becoming invisible. Just because, as you say, of this new world coming, this brave new high-tech world with all its blessings and curses."
"Why did you leave your DMV file and your military records partly intact? You could have wiped them out completely long ago."
He smiled. "Being too clever, maybe.
I thought I'd just change my address on them, a few salient details, so they weren't much use to anyone. But by leaving them in place, I could always go back to look at them and see if somebody was searching for me.
You booby-trapped them?
Sorta, yeah. I buried little programs in those computers, very deep, very subtle. Each time anyone goes into my DMV or military files without using the little code I implanted, the system adds one asterisk to the end of the last sentence in the file. The idea was that I'd check once or twice a week, and if I saw asterisks, saw that someone was investigating me, well, then maybe it would be time to walk away from the cabin in Malibu and just move on.
Move on where?
Anywhere. Just move on and keep moving.
Paranoid, she said.
Damn paranoid.
She laughed quietly. So did he.
He said, by the time I left that task force, I knew that the way the world's changing, everybody's going to have somebody looking for him sooner or later, and most people most of the time are going to wish they hadn't been findable.
Ellie checked her wristwatch. Maybe we should take a look at that map now.
They have a slew of maps up front, he said.
She watched him walk forward to the cockpit door. His shoulders were slumped. He moved with evident weariness, and he still appeared to be somewhat stiff from his days of immobility. Suddenly, Ellie was chilled by a feeling that Spencer Grant was not going to make it through this with her, that he was going to die somewhere in the night ahead. The foreboding was perhaps not strong enough to be called an explicit premonition, but it was more powerful than a mere hunch. The possibility of losing him left her half sick with dread. She knew then that she cared for him even more than she had been able to admit. When he returned with the map, he said, "What's wrong?"
"Nothing. Why?"
"You look like you've seen a ghost."
"Just tired," she lied, "and starved."
"I can do something about the starved part."
As he sat in the seat across the aisle again, he produced four candy bars from the pockets of his fleece-lined denim jacket.
"Where'd you get these?"
"The boys up front have a snack box. They were happy to share. They're really a couple of swell guys."
"Especially with a gun to their heads."
"Especially then," he agreed.
Rocky sat up and cocked his good ear with keen interest when he smelled the candy bars.
"Ours," Spencer said firmly. "When we're out of the air and on the ground again, we'll stop and get some real food for you, something healthier than this."
The dog licked his chops.
"Look, pal," Spencer said, "I didn't stop in the supermarket to graze on the wreckage like you did. I need every bite of these or I'll collapse on my face. Now you just lie down and forget it, okay?"
Rocky yawned, looked around with pretended disinterest, and stretched out on the deck again. "You two have an incredible rapport," she said.
"Yeah, we're Siamese twins, separated at birth. You couldn't know that, of course, because he's had a lot of plastic surgery."
She could not take her eyes off his face. More than weariness was visible in it, she could see the certain shadow of death. Disconcertingly perceptive and alert to her mood, Spencer said,
"What?"
"Thanks for the candy."
"It would have been filet mignon if I could have swung it."
He unfolded the map. They held it between their seats, studying the territory around Grand Junction, Colorado. Twice she dared look at him, and each glimpse made her heart race with fear. She could too clearly see the skull beneath the skin, the promise of the grave that was usually so well concealed by the mask of life. She felt ignorant, silly, superstitious, like a foolish child. There were other explanations besides omens and portents and psychic images of tragedy to come. Perhaps after the Thanksgiving night, when Danny and her parents had been snatched away forever, this fear would plague her every time that she crossed the line between caring for people and loving them.
Roy landed at Stapleton International Airport in Denver aboard the Learjet after 25 minutes in a holding pattern. The local office of the agency had assigned two operatives to work with him, as he had requested on the scrambler phone while in flight. Both men, Bert Rink and Oliver Fordyce, were waiting in the parking bay as the Lear taxied into it. They were in their early 30s, tall, clean-shaven. They wore black top coats, dark blue suits, dark ties, white shirts, and black Oxfords with rubber rather than leather soles. All that was also as Roy had requested. Rink and Fordyce had new clothes for Roy that were virtually identical to their own outfits. Having shaved and showered aboard the jet during the trip from Cedar City, Roy needed only to change clothes before they could switch from the plane to the black Chrysler Superstretch limousine that was waiting at the foot of the portable stairs. The day was bone-freezing. The sky was as clear as an Arctic sea and deeper than time. Icicles hung along the eaves of building roofs, and banks of snow marked the far limits of runways. Stapleton was on the northeastern edge of the city, and their appointment with Dr. Sabrina Palma was beyond the southwest suburbs. Roy would have insisted on a police escort under one pretense or another, except that he didn't want to call any more attention to themselves than absolutely necessary.
"It's a 4:30 appointment,"
Fordyce said as he and Rink settled into the back of the limousine, facing to the rear, while Roy sat facing forward.
"We'll make it with a few minutes to spare."
The driver had been instructed not to dawdle. They accelerated away from the Learjet as if they did have a police escort. Rink passed a 9x12 white envelope to Roy.
"These are all the documents you required."
"You have your Secret Service credentials?" Roy asked. From suit coat pockets, Rink and Fordyce withdrew their ID wallets and flipped them open to reveal holographic identification cards with their photographs and authentic SS badges. Rink's name for the upcoming meeting was Sidney Eugene Tarkenton. Fordyce was Lawrence Albert Olmeyer. Roy extracted his own ID wallet from among the documents in the white envelope. He was J. Robert Cotter.
"Let's all remember who we are. Be sure to call one another by these names," Roy said.
"I don't expect you'll need to say much or even anything at all. I'll do the talking. You're there primarily to lend the whole thing an air of realism. You'll enter Dr. Palmer's office behind me and post yourselves to the left and the right of the door. Stand with your feet about 18 inches apart, arms down in front of you, one hand clasped over the other. When I introduce you to her, you'll say, 'Doctor,' and nod, or 'Pleased to meet you,' and nod. Stoic at all times, about as expressionless as a Buckingham Palace guard, eyes straight ahead, no fidgeting. If you're asked to sit down, you'll politely say, 'No, thank you, doctor.' Yes, I know it's ridiculous, but this is how people are used to seeing Secret Service agents in the movies, so any indication that you're a real human being will ring false to her. Is that understood, Sidney?"
"Yes, sir."
"Is that understood, Lawrence?"
"I prefer Larry," said Oliver Fordyce.
"Is that understood, Larry?"
"Yes, sir."
"Good." Roy withdrew the other documents from the envelope, examined them, and was satisfied. He was taking one of the greatest risks of his career, but he was remarkably calm. He was not even assigning agents to seek the fugitives in Salt Lake City or anywhere else directly north of Cedar City, because he was confident that their flight in that direction had been a ruse. They had altered course immediately after dropping under the radar floor. He doubted that they would go west back into Nevada because that state's empty fastness provided too little cover, which left south and east. After the two enchiladas of information from Gary Duval, Roy had reviewed everything he knew about Spencer Grant and had decided that he could accurately predict in which direction the man, and with luck the woman, would proceed. East-northeast. Moreover, he had divined exactly where Grant would impact at the end of that east-northeast trajectory, even more confidently than he could have plotted the line of a bullet from the barrel of a rifle. Roy was calm, not solely because he trusted in his well-exercised powers of deductive reasoning, but also because in this special instance, destiny walked with him as surely as blood flowed in his veins. "Can I assume that the team I asked for earlier today is on its way to Vale?" he asked.
12 men, said Fordyce.
Glancing at his watch, Rink said,
"They should be meeting Duval there just about now."
For 16 years, Michael Ackblom, a.k.a. Spencer Grant, had been denying the deep desire to return to that place, repressing the need, resisting the powerful magnet of the past. Nevertheless, either consciously or unconsciously, he had always known that he must pay a visit to those old haunts sooner or later. Otherwise, he would have sold the property to be rid of that tangible reminder of a time he wanted to forget, just as he had sloughed off his old name for a new one. He'd retained ownership for the same reason that he'd never sought surgery to have his facial scar minimized.
"He's punishing himself with the scar," Dr. Nero Mondello had said in his white-on-white office in Beverly Hills, "reminding himself of something he would like to forget but feels obligated to remember."
As long as Grant had lived in California and had followed a pressure-free daily routine, perhaps he could have indefinitely resisted the call of that killing ground in Colorado. But now he was running for his life and under tremendous pressure, and he had come near enough to his old home to ensure that the siren song of the past would be irresistible. Roy was betting everything that the son of the serial killer would return to the marrow of the nightmare from which all the blood had sprung.
Spencer Grant had unfinished business at the ranch outside Vale, and only two people in the world knew what it was. Beyond the heavily tinted windows of the speeding limousine, in the rapidly dwindling winter afternoon, the modern city of Denver appeared to be smoky and as vaguely defined at the edges as piles of ancient ruins entwined with ivy and shrouded with moss. West of Grand Junction, inside the Colorado National Monument, the Jet Ranger landed in an eroded basin between one parenthesis of red rock formations and another of low hills mantled with junipers and pinon pines. A skin of dry snow, less than half an inch thick, was flayed into crystalline clouds by the downdraft. 100 feet away, a green-black screen of trees served as a backdrop to the bright silhouette of a white Ford Bronco. A man in a green ski suit stood at the open tailgate, watching the helicopter. Spencer stayed with the crew while Ellie went outside to have a word with the man at the truck. With the Jet Ranger engine off and the rotor blades dead, the rock and tree-rimmed basin was as silent as a deserted cathedral. She could hear nothing but the squeak and crunch of her own footsteps on the snow-filmed frozen earth. As she drew close to the Bronco, she saw a tripod with a camera on it. Related gear was spread across the lowered tailgate. The photographer, bearded and furious, was spouting steam from his nostrils as if about to explode. "You ruined my shot! That pristine swath of snow curving up to that thrusting fiery rock! Such contrast, such drama, and now ruined!" She glanced back at the rock formations beyond the helicopter. They were still fiery, a luminous stained glass red in the beams of the westering sun, and they were still thrusting. But he was right about the snow. It wasn't pristine any longer. "Sorry." "Sorry doesn't cut it," he said sharply. She studied the snow in the vicinity of the Bronco. As far as she could tell, his were the only footprints in it. He was alone. "What the hell are you doing out here anyway?" the photographer demanded. "There are sound restrictions here. Nothing as noisy as that allowed. This is a wildlife preserve." "Then cooperate and preserve your own," she said, drawing the SIG 9mm from under her leather jacket. In the Jet Ranger again, while Ellie held the pistol and the micro-Uzi, Spencer cut strips out of the upholstery. He used those lengths of leather to bind the wrists of each of the three men to the arms of the passenger seats in which he'd made them sit.
"I won't gag you," he said. "Nobody's likely to hear you shouting, anyway."
"We'll freeze to death," the pilot fretted.
"You'll work your arms loose in half an hour at most. Another half an hour or 45 minutes to walk out to the highway we crossed over when we flew in. Not nearly enough time to freeze."
"Just to be safe," Ellie assured them. "As soon as we get to a town, we'll call the police and tell them where you are."
Twilight had arrived. Stars were beginning to appear in the deep purple of the eastern sky as it curved down to the horizon. While Spencer drove the Bronco, Rocky panted in Ellie's ear from the cargo area behind her seat. They found the way overland toward the highway with no difficulty. The route was clearly marked by the tire tracks in the snow that the truck had made on its trip into the picturesque basin.
"Why'd you tell them we'd call the police?" Spencer wondered.
"You want them to freeze?"
"I don't think there's much chance of that."
"I won't risk it."
"Yeah, but these days it's possible, maybe not likely, but possible, that any call you make to a police department is going to be received on a caller ID line. Not just if you punch 911. Fact is, a smaller city like Grand Junction, with not so much street crime or so many demands on resources, is a lot more likely to have money to spend on fancy communication systems with all the bells and whistles. You call them, then they know right away the address you're phoning from. It comes up on the screen in front of the police operator, and then they'll know what direction we went, what road we left Grand Junction on."
"I know, but we're not going to make it that simple for them," she said, and explained what she had in mind.
"I like it," he said.